This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, Affirm, Klarna, Afterpay, you know the names and the big players when it comes to the buy now, pay later industry, also known as BNPLs. They are the subject of this week's Bloomberg Business Week cover story, that magazine issue, now on newsstands. It's also online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
A great group in the byline, Esme Deprez, Evan Weinberger, and Jenny Serain all chipping in on the story. Esme Deprez is projects and investigations reporter for Bloomberg News. Esme joins us on the phone from California. Joel Weber is with us now. He's editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, Joel, the concept of buy now, pay later, it really took off over the last couple of years. What could go wrong with, you know, buying something now but paying later?
Yeah, it sounds so good.
Right.
Like,
sounds pretty good.
Just give it to me now. So what really stood out here was how much we were all suddenly being inundated with sort of these offers. Like, you go to a checkout and it's sort of like, you know, do you want to pay in 4 easy payments? And we were sort of like, where did this come from? Yeah. Like, yeah. It is suddenly everywhere. And lo and behold, it really took off during the pandemic. And we were all doom scrolling and hoping consumption would bail us out of a pandemic and, you know, or at least maybe feel better for a moment. And it turned out that this industry just boomed on it. But now we're seeing economic headwinds, regulators have taken note. And lo and behold, as we'll talk with Esme here, there's good old-fashioned debt problems, even when you're right. You know, supposedly paying in 4 easy payments. So Esme, as you kind of dove into this topic, I'm curious, there's a real fundamental loophole that the buy now, pay later industry is built on, which was, it's one thing if you pay in 5 payments, but it's another in 4. Why that distinction, and why does it matter so much?
Yeah, so this story really focuses on the pay in 4 model in particular, and that's what really unites these companies. So Affirm, Afterpay, Klarna, they all kind of do different stuff, but their main product is pay in 4, or one of their main products is pay in 4, and that's what they all do the same. And so the way that they're able to really change the consumer credit game was by bypassing consumer protection regulations. That explains one of the reasons why these have just seemingly exploded overnight. And so if you take the Truth in Lending Act, for example, that's a landmark law enacted in 1968, and it requires extensive disclosures for what are called unsecured consumer loans split into payments of 5 or more. The law doesn't touch pay in 4 because it's pay in 4 payments. And so that's a really, you know, that's a really easy way to understand some of the loopholes that they've been able to, you know, bypass and take off as a result.
Well, let's talk about taking off. Like, how big have these companies become? Because, right, the bigger also kind of sets up the problem that, you know, that they could become a bigger problem down the road, especially as we talk about recession, it feels like on a daily basis. So how big has this industry become?
Usage has increased, you know, over the past few years, usage has increased 300% every year. So consumers, you know, they're really making up a larger part of particularly e-commerce spending. They're slowly creeping into brick and mortar, but it's really just e-commerce. So we're looking at like, you know, a few percentage points of consumer spending online, but obviously growing, you know, every single day. As far as valuations, I mean, if you look at Klarna, the value has dropped significantly recently, but it's still worth $7 billion. Afterpay was sold to Block, the digital payments company, for $29 billion.
Incredible.
So these companies are very big. They're making hay. They're minting billionaires. And as Joel said, though, you know, we may see the party coming to an end, or at least, you know, getting a little bit less fun.
That never happens.
Yeah, no, never. You know, that Klarna headline, you know, when the valuation got slashed recently, was really interesting because it was sort of like, if everything seemed like it was going great for this industry, and then you saw that valuation get slashed, and it was sort of like, wait, what? So what is your reporting bear out there? What's going on with the industry, and why are valuations maybe tenuous suddenly?
There's a number of reasons. So first of all, losses are up. They're seeing, you know, more people. Obviously, you know, usage has increased, so they're having more customers, but also more customers are, you know, unable to pay back their loans. So investors obviously don't like that. Stocks are way down. You know, competition is increasing. Apple recently announced that it would get into the game with its version of Pay in 4 called Apple Pay Later. PayPal joined the crew a couple years ago with its version of Pay in 4. You know, even big banks these days are looking at BNPL. It's less so Pay in 4 and more so just like kind of old-fashioned installment loans that they want to apply the BNPL name to because it's such a hot name. But also we saw, you know, we looked at Consumer Financial Protection Bureau complaints, their database, and complaints are mounting. And then, of course, regulation is likely coming. The FTC is now looking into this industry and trying to really figure out, like, what kind of consumer harm is happening. And we definitely found that there was absolutely consumer harm happening. I mean, in part because it's just so easy to get these loans. You know, the old traditional credit system, you know, excludes people unfairly a lot of the times, but it also sometimes, you know, prohibits people from being able to take on debt because they truly cannot. You know, they truly cannot take on debt because they're not going to be able to pay it back. And this is a problem. You know, the BNPL industry often will give you a loan even if you can't qualify elsewhere. So, you know, that's really the heart of a lot of the problems we're seeing.
Esme, will you go through the business model here and how these companies make money? Because I've seen these checking out when I'm buying stuff online, and they offer essentially 0% interest if you pay in four in some cases. So how do they make money if they're not charging you for the, you know, ability to pay back over time?
Exactly. You know, usually pay in four is always interest free. You can get hit with late fees, but primarily what BNPL companies do to make money is that they charge the merchant a percentage of whatever it is you're buying. And the merchant thinks that that's worth it because you're more likely to buy with these things. So there's less quote-unquote cart abandonment. You're not going to walk away from your cart. You're actually going to go through with the purchase. And then also your cart is going to be bigger. You're going to buy more stuff because you think your monkey brain thinks that it's cheaper because you're only paying in four, you're paying in four payments, not all, you know, not one big price tag at once. So primarily merchant fees make up a big part of the revenue of across the board for these companies. You also, you know, they do some Klarna and Affirm, for example, also have longer term interest loans that they offer. And so they make some interest off that. But this is kind of their main selling point. I mean, they really say the merchants are their primary customer. You know, we as shoppers think that we're getting the good deal, but really it's merchants that are their primary customer. So that's really what they say helps distinguish them from credit cards makes them better than credit cards, because credit card companies, you know, credit card issuers, they make a lot of money off of the interest and fees that they charge on people that don't pay their bills on time.
The other thing that's really fascinating that Esme goes into, and you can read it on your own, is about how there's a whole shadow credit industry that's sprung up here too.
All right. It's a great read. It's the cover story. Jill Weber, Esme DePrez, thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, on the Bloomberg today, an update on how funding plans for monkeypox are at risk because of an impasse on Capitol Hill over additional aid for COVID-19. Meantime, Tim, there are nearly 3,600 monkeypox cases across almost every state, D.C. and Puerto Rico. Maybe it doesn't sound like a lot, but do you remember when COVID didn't sound like a lot either?
I'm not
saying apples to apples.
No,
but
not apples to apples. But at the same time, the World Health Organization, you know, taking the extraordinary step over the weekend of declaring it an emergency. Let's get into it with Dr. Tom Inglesby, director at Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins at Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Inglesby joins us on the phone from Baltimore. The Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Inglesby, great to have you with us. I mentioned the extraordinary step that we heard from the World Health Organization, essentially for the second time in 3 years, declaring, you know, another global health emergency, this time monkeypox. How should we be thinking about this, especially in the context of what we've learned about viruses over the last 2.5, close to 3 years?
Yeah, well, first of all, very good to be with you. Thanks for having me. I think you're right to think about kind of the frequency with which we're seeing these new viruses. And in the past, in between big events, I think we've kind of started to think that they won't happen again. But I think we're really looking at kind of the new global normal. We will continue to have infectious disease crises in the world, and we just need to get prepared for them, have good stockpiles of medicines, be ready to react quickly. And I'm really happy that the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency, because I think it helps focus the attention of countries and hopefully get more resources for the response.
So it means, since we've learned so much over the last two and a half years because of COVID, we're going to get the next pandemic or infectious disease crisis. We're going to get it right. We're going to be really well prepared, right?
Sorry, I can't stop laughing.
Forgive me. I grew up in a large family with a lot of sarcasm.
I think we are, it doesn't always feel like it, but we are building new capacities in the world. In the United States, we have, this time around, we have a vaccine that's ready to go. We don't have nearly enough of it, but the vaccine was created some time ago. So as opposed to the COVID vaccine, which took about a year to come online, we do have a vaccine that's ready to go. We do have a medicine that works against this virus that's also ready to go. It's just a matter of getting it in the to the places that need it fast enough, and getting it, getting doctors and healthcare providers very aware of this illness so they can know to test for it and know to get the vaccine and the treatment for people who need it.
So forgive me my sarcasm, but I can't tell you how many, you know, Dr. Inglesby, people have come up to me. They know what we do for a living. We know we have incredible access to the likes of someone like yourself who are on the front lines and are hearing about it, seeing about it directly. People coming up to me and they're like, are you worried about this? And I don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are in a high risk group, then I do think you should be worried about it. Right now, that high risk group is men who have sex with men. And so a lot of attention is now being focused on providing that community with information, awareness, especially the healthcare providers who take care of that demographic, making sure that they have access to vaccine as quickly as we get vaccine online. If you're not in that group, then I think it's reasonable to be paying attention to it, just to be tracking it. Mm-hmm. But it is not now posing a risk to the general population. It is possible that if we don't get control of it over time, that it could move into different groups of people in the United States. But this is not a disease that spreads like COVID or influenza, yeah, person to person through the air. This requires very close contact, skin-to-skin contact, or household contact between people who are very close to each other. So it's never going to be like what we experienced with COVID, but it's something to pay attention to, because we got to get it right.
Does it kill?
It has in past years, when it was mostly in Africa, in a number of countries in Africa, it did have some mortality associated with it, you know, single digit percentages, yeah, you know, between 1% and 5%. It is not, does not appear to be killing people yet in the world. There have been a few cases of people who've died, but very, very, very small numbers. But it is causing very painful illness, mm-hmm, prolonged painful illness for some of the people who've gotten it. So we really want to make sure that we do everything we can to contain it and end it in the United States, so it doesn't become a problem that lasts and that's out there as another thing that people have to be worried about.
Can you be really quick, 10 seconds? Are we ready for the next COVID-like pandemic as a society? Just quickly.
We're not ready, but I think we are, we're moving in positive directions. We just can't take our eye off the ball.
All right. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Dr. Tom Inglesby, he's director of the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropy.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the sky is not so friendly as JetBlue and Frontier battled over buying deep discounter Spirit Airlines. The battle is over, as you know, JetBlue clinching a deal one day after Spirit called off a planned merger with Frontier. Well, today, Barry Biffle, he's the president and CEO of Frontier Airlines, telling Bloomberg, our own Katie Greifeld, about walking away from that deal with Spirit, but hinting it might not all be over.
Listen, I'm not going to speculate, but look, we're always looking for ways to save more consumers' money. So I'm not going to close the door on it, but let's let them, pursue their path, and we'll see how it goes.
Barry, JetBlue is calling the doors closed.
We'll see how it goes. That's what he said.
Exactly. Well, time will tell. Well, let's get to it with our own Bloomberg Intelligence senior aerospace defense and airlines analyst, George Ferguson. He's on the phone from New Jersey. George, so glad to have you back with Tim and myself. So are you surprised that it kind of went this way? And do you agree that maybe the door still might be open for Frontier?
So not surprised that it went this way. You know, really, I think after we saw JetBlue, up their proposals, I think if Frontier had more to bring, they would have brought it, and we just didn't see them bring anything, I think, significantly more to the deal to try to win it. And so it seemed to me that they were just trying to convince shareholders that in the long run, it was better to put Spirit together with Frontier, but they, again, weren't ready to bring cash. And so so I wasn't surprised. I thought it was interesting that they – I think we never really finally got a vote yesterday or a tally of a vote. So it just tells me that the shareholders just weren't going to be swayed.
Right.
I mean, there's definitely some discussion in the marketplace today that there are people that are worried that, the DOJ, antitrust wouldn't let this go through. I don't see it. Like, I don't see either of these airlines being so critical to the U.S. Travel business that they couldn't let them, couldn't put them together. They're just not big enough.
Help us,
the country and us.
George, help us understand sort of the test for regulators in a situation like this, because this is a highly regulated industry. So what does Spirit and JetBlue, what do they have to prove to regulators in order for regulators to sign off on this?
Okay, so I'm gonna punt on this one because I have a colleague that spends all day long on the Herschendel whatever index, that they use. I'm just gonna say, they're gonna wanna make sure that it doesn't mean that the industry is too concentrated and that consumers are gonna pay a lot more for fares. And so again, I'm gonna drop back on there are four, major airlines in front of
right.
them, Southwest, American, United, and Delta already. Right, have a huge amount of the marketplace. This is not going to be a lot of the marketplace. There's already competitors underneath the combined two. Alaska will be there, right? We'll have a growing Frontier underneath there. And the beauty of this industry is airlines are always being born, and so we've got Breeze and Avelo and you name it. So
yeah, speaking of JetBlue, right?
yeah, and so I have a hard time imagining someone saying there isn't enough competition in this industry, because there's a heck of a lot of companies in this industry always working to take fares down on each other, always.
Yeah, I mean, right, this. The cycles of, tons of airline names, and then we see consolidation, and then we see more airline names, and then we see consolidation. Like, right, you've seen this movie several times before. I don't know if it's harder to get into it now. I don't know.
I mean, even this quarter, if you think about it, the airlines are approaching 2019 levels of capacity,
yeah.
and they're nowhere near that level of profitability. I mean, Southwest did breach that today. They did a nice job. They said they see fares softening into 3Q. They guided much lower than their 2019 results. They aren't getting back all the increases in costs. It's a very competitive marketplace.
Hey, George, before we let you go, help us understand what a combined JetBlue Spirit would look like. It's going to be run by the CEO.
Tim just wants to know, are you going to get Mint on Spirit?
Yeah, there's no way. I mean, how do they do this? These are different cultures.
So I think they will. I think it's absolutely going the JetBlue direction. It'll be a kinder, gentler, low-cost carrier. I think you will get Mint on some of the routes, right? The routes where you can get people to pay up for. So they're going to have to reconfigure all the Spirit airplanes.
Wow.
Repaint them all, and I think get everyone to be sort of kinder and gentler in their
redo those interiors, right?
Yep, that's a bunch of money involved.
Yeah,
that we put out a piece of research today, put some numbers on that.
Does it still just 10 seconds still be? Is it still though a discount, deep discount airline, or no?
Not deep discount. I think a discount, but not a deep discount. Maybe we'll call it a budget carrier.
Very interesting. Well, maybe then a little bit of a new strategy there for JetBlue. George Ferguson, we ran out of time. We wanted to talk a little bit about the air show in the UK, but we're going to have to bring you back for that because I'm just curious about some of the major trends going forward. George Ferguson, he's Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, a must read on the Bloomberg when it comes to all things in this industry. Thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive, say you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed, everybody. We are just about 9 minutes away from the closing bell on this Thursday. A lot going on, and we are seeing a rally underway, another risk trade, building on the gains that we got in yesterday's trade. I'm talking about the equity markets in particular. You heard Charlie talking about it. More than 1% gains on each of those major averages right now, Tim.
Yeah, I wonder if this is a bear market rally, like our guest yesterday said, or if, you know, it's here to stay. Yeah. Let's dig into the tech part of this with James Chalkmok, partner and a technology analyst at Clockwise Capital. James joining us on the phone from Miami this afternoon. James, good to have you back with us. It's been a while. How are you?
I'm well. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's talk tech because it's a sector that you watch really closely. Worst, is it behind us? I mean, we've gotten some important tech earnings this week. We've learned a lot. Is the worst behind us when it comes to the sell-off?
Well, I think what you can gather from this week's earnings, especially looking at, you know, the tech bellwethers like Microsoft and Google, is that the secular shifts that we're seeing on the digital and digital transformation side are far stronger than the macro pressures that we're seeing. And I think you're also seeing a bifurcation between the highest, best of breed qualities that can weather the storm. The macro storm and the companies that have been having micro issues that benefited from COVID but now are having trouble gaining their footing once again. So, you know, we remain optimistic. Obviously, the macro picture is something that no company is immune from, but at least gathering from the results that we've seen this week, there's certainly reason for optimism, especially given the valuation.
Okay, so help us understand which companies you consider sort of the leaders here versus which ones can't handle this new macroeconomic environment. I want to start with Meta Platforms, which is just can't get a break when it comes to shareholders. Is that one of the ones that's going to be left behind?
I think as it stands right now, if we look at it in a vacuum in July 2022, it looks like it will be. I think there are structural issues that the company needs to overcome. Now, granted, the comps will get easier next year once they anniversary the privacy changes over at Apple, but I think it's TBT. There are some bright spots with impressions growth in the teens, ad impressions, as well as the DAU number ticking up slightly higher. But at the end of the day, you know, that's in the show me story camp as it stands right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's a potentially big shift in terms of their business, right? And so who knows, that story yet to be told. All right, when you look at some of the other names, I mean, what we got from Microsoft, was that kind of calming for you?
Absolutely. And I think one point on Meta is that I think the lesson learned is anytime you see a company change their name, you have to take a second look at it. I mean, we saw the same thing with Square changing to Block, right?
Yeah.
With respect to Microsoft, I think it was very encouraging. I think coming out of COVID, some companies are worse positioned. Some companies are positioned via the status quo. Mm-hmm. And some companies are better positioned. And I think Microsoft is definitely in the latter camp. The cloud services continue to drive the business. The adoption is there. And then you have new optionality, like on initiatives such as on the gaming side. So that's one that that we like and we own.
What about, I just want to ask you about Google before we start looking forward. Google also, how do you feel about that one?
Google, we like it. We own it. Not as much in size as some other companies, just given that advertising as discretionary as it is, you know, that's one of the first things that pulled back. But the reading the tea leaves there, you can I think deduce that, you know, this is a company with first party data, unlike a Facebook, that can weather the macro storm a little bit better than others. And at the same time, you're seeing the strength of their platform, and I think the bright days are ahead for Google in terms of, you know, which companies will perform better, provide a better return over the next 6 months. I think there are other companies that will, but Google, our takeaway was certainly neutral to positive.
All right, let's talk Amazon, because last time you were on with us, James, it was back in April. You said that Amazon has more levers than any other mega cap out there. You said that you liked it. Has your opinion on Amazon changed at all? And we get, reminder, you know, in just a few minutes, we're going to hear from the company on its latest report.
No, the opinion on the company hasn't changed. I think, you know, if we had to look back and about our positioning at that point, probably underappreciated the Fed's influence, you know, on the market. But structurally speaking, the company is certainly more sound than it's ever been. And I think you can argue that a lot of these companies, Amazon included, have come out of COVID, come out of managing the macro issues and managing the inflationary issues better than they would have otherwise. So I think the companies are stronger and more nimble and more agile as a result of this. And I think for the quarter, you know, we've seen retail results, you know, mixed bag there, but, you know, top line possibly, you know, under pressure because of the macro. But in the bottom line, they're working through the cost changes. But as we look forward into 3Q and the back half of this year, I think that's where you're going to see the leverage that we talked about last time come to fruition. So we remain very bullish on Amazon, and it remains our largest position.
Yeah, I think about whether it's an Apple or an Amazon, how much they are entrenched in my world personally. And when I go to buy something, how quickly I go to Amazon because I kind of know. And I just, for the first time, actually went to a locker, had something delivered, and it was like such a great positive experience.
Great news. You're going to get to go to Dr. Amazon soon.
I don't know about that. Hey, James, real quickly, 10 seconds. If Amazon comes in weak, is that a buying opportunity? Very quickly, please.
Yes. I mean, in short, yes, absolutely.
You know, I know you can be quick. Thank you so much. We love talking
with you. We still have like 10 extra seconds for you too, James. That's
no,
good.
We don't actually. We got to run. James Chacmok, he's partner and tech analyst over at Clockwise Capital, joining us on the phone from Miami.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.